and for this second, and we'll be right back after this.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
I'm David Suzuki. Cut your heat and energy use by 10% and you'll be making a real difference combating global warming. The future is in your hands.
Shrink your footprint, grow your wallet, cool the planet. Find out how at davidsuzuki.org.
I'm Hilal.
I'm Gözde, and we are bringing you a new music show called Flaneur. And our attempt is to explore everyday life through music.
We are going to explore with you the different genres, arabesque, rap, indie, Anatolian rock, pop, folk, in Turkey, in Canada, and the diverse geographies across the world.
We invite you to join us on our journey. Don't forget to tune in on Fridays at 9 p.m.
And it is 5:01. Welcome back now into the second hour. And you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And in the first hour, you heard readings from the Poetry on Record, 98 Poets Read Their Own Work, for disc CD set, and then that's 1888 to 2006. You heard Simon Ortiz, Sylvia Plath, Ted Hughes, Adrian Lewis, Ann Waldman, and Carolyn Forché. In this second hour, you're going to hear readings from that same source, readings by Deborah Garrison, Elise Passion, Elizabeth Alexander, James Tate, and Joy Harjo. Again, just my usual start of the hour announcement. Occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but it's all played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author or performer and the piece. This is, again, in case you missed it at the top of the first hour, the sixth in what is a seven-week series. Again, just as a brief introduction, I have a four-CD set that was given to me as a gift many years ago, and I've used it occasionally over this show's nearly 12-year run as a source of readings for the show. In the past, often I would just play a small portion of one or two or something of the CDs. Then I might play the whole of them, and I could usually do that in a couple of weeks just by just going, and you heard, and up next you're going to hear, sort of thing. And but I decided, did this last year actually, started, I put together some sort of short, the introductions to each of the poets. I wanted to honor them, and also wanted to learn more about a lot of these poets were just words on a page to me. I knew of them, and not even all of them, but even the ones I knew, I really didn't know anything about. So I wanted to honor the poets if I was going to play them. I decided at that point if I was going to play them on this show, I wanted to at least honor them a little bit. And so those of you out there who, maybe many of you know them all, or maybe many of you don't know them all, but in any case, I wanted people to have an opportunity to at least hear a little bit about them, and if you are really interested, you can explore much more, I'm sure. So anyway, that's what we'll be doing again the rest of this hour, and again next week, and have done for the past 5 weeks, so let's, without further ado, oh, yeah, just a brief mention. These are recorded in the technology of the time. We're getting in the later years of it now, so that's not very noticeable. Also, I have included this year a bit of music to go along with some of the readings. So it's usually one or two songs in an hour. Oftentimes, if a reading reminds me of a song or something like that, or I feel I can just play them back to back, I will do that. Otherwise, there might be a short break, but still, I don't know. I'll just let it go at that. Let's begin today's second hour of the show in this series, again, from the fourth disc now of the four disc set called Poetry on Record, 98 Poets Read Their Own Work, 1888 to 2006, following my brief introduction to her, you're going to hear a poem by Deborah Garrison. Deborah Garrison was born in 1965 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Her father died when she was about 15, and she and her two sisters were raised by their mother, an accountant. Garrison earned her bachelor's degree in creative writing from Brown University in 1986. She subsequently earned her master's degree in literature from New York University. On August 10th, 1986, she married. Also that year, she joined the staff of The New Yorker, where she worked for the next 15 years, starting as editorial staff and ultimately becoming the senior nonfiction editor. She is now the poetry editor at Alfred A. Knopf and senior editor at Pantheon Books. She was hired by Knopf by Sonny Mehta, president of that group, to replace publishing industry icon Harry Ford, because he said, "There is something so fresh about Deborah, and I admire her poetry," end quote. Garrison also edits fiction and nonfiction for Pantheon Books. Novelist Julia Glath, winner of the 2002 Book Award, calls Garrison an incredible editor, end quote. Garrison's first volume of poetry, A Working Girl Can't Win, was published in 1998, has themes relating to the young female, professional, friendship, love, grief, and passion. Her second volume, The Second Child, published almost 10 years after the first, deals mainly with themes related to motherhood. Reviews of Garrison's poetry have been mixed. Some were at least somewhat negative. John Updike's comments are printed on the book jacket of Working Girl and repeated liberally throughout book reviews. Of her poems, he declares, quote, "With their short lines, sneaky rhymes, and casual leaps of metaphor, Garrison's poems have a Dixonian intensity and the American recluse's air of independent-minded, lightly populated singleness." Garrison is the first to acknowledge that her poetry would not be on Knopf's publication list, and insists that her own poetry is not indicative either of her taste in poetry or in her breadth as an editor. However, her supporters suggest that the fact that her poetry is accessible and commercially successful does not detract from its value. One critic warns that the reader should notice that, quote, "The accessibility of Garrison's free verse should not obscure the sound effects and subtle rhymes which give shape to the work. When the occasion calls for metaphor, Garrison is ready with appropriate responses," end quote. Any discussion of Derek Garrison's work has led to debate over whether poetry that is not obscure can be considered good. As a poet and editor, Garrison expresses an interest in having more readers experience the enrichment that poetry can bring, because she says, quote, "Most readers don't even know they need poetry," end quote. She also notes that, again, quote, "Poetry can be pretentious sometimes, and if people feel poetry is this high citadel that you can't get into, it's bad for poetry," end quote. Here with a single poem is Deborah Garrison with her poem called "I Saw You Walking."
This is Deborah Garrison reading my poem, "I Saw You Walking." I saw you walking through Newark Penn Station in your shoes of white ash. At the corner of my nervous glance, your dazed passage first forced me away, tracing the crescent birth you'd give a drunk, a lurcher, nuzzling all comers with ill will and his stench. But not this one, not today. one shirt arms sheared clean from the shoulder, the whole bare limb wet with muscle and shining dimly pink, the other full sheathed in cotton, Brooks Brothers type, the cuff yet buttoned at the wrist, a parody of careful dress, preparedness. So you had not rolled up your sleeves yet this morning, when your suit jacket, here are the pants, dark gray with subtle stripe, as worn by men like you on ordinary days, and briefcase, you've none, reverse commuter from the pit, with nothing to carry but your life, were torn from you, as your life was not. Your face itself seemed to be walking, leading your body north, though the age of the face, blank and ashen, passing forth and away from me, was unclear, the sandy crown of hair powdered white like your feet, but underneath not yet gray, 47, 48, the age of someone's father. And I trembled for your luck, for your broad, dusted back, half-shirted, walking away. I should have dropped to my knees to thank God you were alive. Oh, my God, in whom I don't believe.
And you just heard a poem by Deborah Garrison, and from, again, the four-disc set, Poetry on Record, 98 Poets Read Their Work. And again, the years 1888 to 2006. Coming up next, following my introduction to her, you're going to hear a poem by Elise Passion called, let's just do the intro first. Was born in 1959, is an American and Osage poet. She is the co-founder and co-editor of Poetry in Motion, a program that places poetry posters in subways and buses across the country. The daughter of renowned prima ballerina Maria Tolchief and Chicago contractor Henry D. Passion, she was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, where she attended the Francis W. Parker School. She is a member of the Osage Nation. While an undergraduate at Harvard University, she received the Lloyd McKim Garrison Medal for Poetry and served as poetry editor of the Harvard Advocate. At Oxford University, where she received her master's in philosophy and doctorate in philosophy degrees in 20th century British and American literature, she co-founded and co-edited Oxford Poetry. Executive director of the Poetry of Society of Literature, she co-founded, Executive Director of the Poetry of Society of America from 1988 until 2001. She has edited numerous anthologies, including the New York Times bestsellers Poetry Speaks. Her books of poetry include most recently The Nightlife, as well as Bestiary, Infidelities, and winner of the Nicholas Roerich Prize, for that book, and Houses, Coasts. Her books have been published in numerous magazines and anthologies, including The New Yorker, Poetry, and The Best American Poetry, 2018. She teaches in the MFA writing program at the School of Art Institute of Chicago. She lives in Chicago with her husband, Stuart Brainerd, and their two children. Somewhat mentioned in part, she has published four collections of poetry. Her work has appeared in a number of anthologies. She has edited or co-edited six books of poetry and has received five awards for her work. Here is Elise Passion.
Two Standards, at a Native Writers Conference in Norman, Oklahoma. Jones, 1/8. I'm a quarter. When we walk into Billy's, I want to look like her, full Osage. You wouldn't find an Indian here, she tells me, if not for the conference. And the cigar-chewing driver, shuttling in from the Will Rogers Airport, confides, I never seen so many Indians all in one spot. The bar's packed like a bar should be. Joan shows me off, introducing her friends to a light-haired, East Coast-educated outsider whose mother, Betty Tolchief, is Oklahoma's pride. At that table are some Osages you should meet. They know my relatives in Fairfax, though they come from Pawhuska, Pawnee. Angela says the tall chiefs, the keepers of the drum, will host the Osage dances next June. Will you join us? You'll be given your Osage name. Even though my grandmother Tall Chief's daughters became famous as ballet dancers, she displayed photographs of my mother and aunt when they were 12, 11, in Osage ceremonial dress, performing at a powwow. My mother said her father's mother taught her those dances. I say, when asked, I never wanted to dance, but here in Billy's, with the jukebox repeating the Beatles' Twist and Shout, all I want is to dance and to adopt my mother's Osage name, Wakse Thunba, two standards. All I want is to return to Oklahoma and answer Angela, yes, though New York City's half a continent away. I am my mother's daughter. Two standards. And tonight, forgetting my given name, I will take that ancestral one.
Thank you.
And before the music, you heard Elise Passion from the four-disc set called Poetry on Record. 98 poets read their work. And as mentioned at the start of the show, sometimes I just bleed a song right after. I usually mention that I'm going to do that, but I forgot to do that this time. Anyway, the group you heard was called October Project. This was off their first self-titled album that was actually released in 1993. You heard a song called Take Me As I Am. And October Project is a group based in New York City. They began in 1991. They were together for 4 years in the early 2000s. Well, they were together for 4 years back then, and then again for about six years in the early 2000s, and then they became back together, a slightly different formation, in 2010. They remain active to the day. They produced 4 studio albums, 5 EPs, and a few singles over the course of their careers. So anyway, that's who you heard, and as we move back into the four-disc set, following an introduction to her, you're going to hear a poem by Elizabeth Alexander. Elizabeth Alexander was born in 1962, is an American poet, essayist, playwright, and president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation since 2018. Previously, she was a professor for 15 years at Yale University, where she taught poetry and chaired the African American Studies Department. She then joined the faculty of Columbia University in 2016 as the Tam Mellon Professor in the Humanities in the Department of English and Comparative Literature. Alexander was born in Harlem, New York City. After she was born, the family moved to Washington, D.C. She was just a toddler when her parents brought her in August 1963 to the march in Washington, site of Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech. Alexander recalled that, quote, politics was in the drinking water at my house, end quote. She also took ballet as a child, finished high school, graduated in 1980, and she went to get her BA at Yale University in 1984, completed, I believe. She attended poetry at Boston University under Derek Walcott and got her master's in 1987. Alexander originally entered studying fiction writing, but Walcott looked at her pod diary and saw the poetry potential. Alexander said, he gave me a huge gift. He took a cluster of words and he lineated it, and I saw it, end quote. In 1992, she received her PhD in English from the University of Pennsylvania. While she was finishing her degree, she taught at nearby Haverford College from 90 to 91, and at this time, she would publish her first work. She began teaching at the University of Chicago in 1991 as an assistant professor of English. While in Chicago in 1992, she won a creative writing fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. She also became a founding faculty member of the Cave Canem Workshop, which helps develop African-American poets. In 1997, she received the University of Chicago's Quantrell Award for Excellence in the Undergraduate Teaching. Later in the year, she moved to Massachusetts to teach at Smith College and became a Grace Hazard Conkling Poet in Residence and the first director of the college's Jackson Poetry Prize. The college's Poetry Center. She has taught African American Studies, English, and Gender Studies. Prizes: the Mellon Professor in the Humanities at Columbia University, awarded an honorary Doctor of Letters degree by Yale University in 2018, was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2019, and was in 2020 elected to the American Philosophical Society. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2005. Her poems, short stories, and critical writings have appeared in widely in such journals and periodicals as the Paris Review, American Poetry Review, the Kenyon Review, the Village Voice, the Women's Review of Books, and the Washington Post. Her play Diva Studies, which was performed by the Yale School of Drama, garnered her a National Endowment for the Arts Creative Writing Fellowship, as well as an Illinois Arts Council Award. She was selected to recite her poem Praise Song for the Day at Barack Obama's presidential inauguration. She has published 8 collections of poetry and 5 other publications of essays, memoirs, or introductions. Here is, again, Elizabeth Alexander with her poem called The American Seer Will Burn Upon the Pyre. Let me double check that. Title doesn't look right. There it is. The Female Seer Will Burn Upon This Pyre. There we go.
This is Elizabeth Alexander. This poem is called The Female Seer Will Burn Upon This Pyre. Sylvia Plath is setting my hair on rollers made from orange juice cans. The hairdo is shaped like a pyre. My locks are improbably long. A pyramid of lemons somehow balances on the rickety table where we sit in the rented kitchen, which smells of singed naps and bergamot. Sylvia Plath is surprisingly adept at rolling my unruly hair. She knows to pull it tight. Few words, her flat American belly, her breasts in a twin sweater set, stack of typed poems on her desk, envelope stamped to go by the door, a freshly baked poppy seed cake, kitchen safety matches, black-eyed Susans in a cobalt jelly jar. She speaks a word, immolate, then a single sentence of prophecy. The hairdo done, the nursery tidy, the floor swept clean of burnt hair and bumblebee husks.
And again, you just heard Elizabeth Alexander's reading from the 4-disc set called Poetry on Record, 98 Poets Read Their Own Work, 1888 to 2006. And coming up next, following an introduction, you're going to hear a poem by James Tate. And let me get him a little closer here. I will say you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. And it is crowding now, 29 minutes after 5 o'clock this Friday afternoon or early evening. Here we go. James Tate is an American poet. He was born in 1943, died in 2015. He was born in Kansas City, Missouri, lived with his mother and his grandparents in his grandparents' house. His father, a pilot in World War II, had died in combat on April 11th, 1944, before Tate was even a year old. Tate and his mother moved out after 7 years when she remarried. The eventual poet said he belonged to a gang in high school and had little interest in the literature. He planned on being a gas station attendant as his uncle had been, but finding that his friends, to his surprise, were going to college, he applied to Kansas State College of Pittsburgh, now called Pittsburgh State University, in 1961. Tate wrote his first poem a few months into college with no external motivation. He observed that poetry, quote, his quote, became a private place that I was hugely drawn to, where I would let my daydreams and my pain come in completely disguised. I knew from the moment that I started writing that I never wanted to be writing about my life. And that's end quote. And in college, he read Wallace Stevens and William Carlos Williams and was, in his words, in heaven. He received his BA in 1965, going on to earn his MFA from the University of Iowa's famed Writers' Workshop. During this period, he was finally exposed to fellow poets, and he became interested in surrealism. Tate taught creative writing at the University of California, Berkeley, Columbia University, and at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he worked from 1971 until his death in 2015. He was a member of the poetry faculty at the MFA program for poets and writers. Tate's writing style is often described as surrealistic, comic, and absurdist. Regarding his own work, Tate said, "My characters usually are, or I'd like to say more often, I don't want to generalize too much, but most often they're in trouble, and they're trying to find some way, some kind of life," end quote. Awards that he's won: a Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, National Institute of Arts and Letters Award, the Poetry Society of America's William Carlos Williams Award, Guggenheim Fellowship, National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship in Poetry, National Book Award for Poetry, 1995 Wallace Stevens Award, and Yale Series of Younger Poets. He was also a Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. His published work is, in addition to being heavily anthologized, including 14 years in the annual The Best American Poetry, he has published 2 collaborations, 1 prose and 1 book of poetry, 3 other books of prose, 14 chapbooks, and 18 collections of poetry. 2 of those actually came out posthumously. So let's go ahead and I'm going to go ahead and play his work, his piece. Just finding the right sheet here. James Tate with a single poem called "The Lost Pilot." And if you listen to the introduction, this is about his father.
The Lost Pilot, from my father, 1922 to 1944. Your face did not rot like the others. The co-pilot, for example, I saw him yesterday. His face is corn mush. His wife and daughter, the poor ignorant people, stare as if he will compose soon. He was more wronged than Job. But your face did not rot like the others. It grew dark and hard like ebony. The features progressed in their distinction. If I could cajole you to come back for an evening, down from your compulsive orbiting, I would touch you, read your face as Dallas, your hoodlum gunner, now with the blistered eyes, reads his Braille editions. I would touch your face as a disinterested scholar touches an original page. However frightening, I would discover you, and I would not turn you in. I would not make you face your wife, or Dallas, or the co-pilot, Jim. You could return to your crazy orbiting, and I would not try to fully understand what it means to you. All I know is this: when I see you, as I have seen you at least once every year of my life, spin across the wilds of the sky like a tiny African god, I feel dead. I feel as if I were the residue of a stranger's life, that I should pursue you. My head cocked toward the sky, I cannot get off the ground, and you, passing over again, fast, perfect, and unwilling to tell me that you were doing well, or that it was mistake that placed you in that world and me in this, or that misfortune placed these worlds in us.
And you just heard James Tate and his reading from the 4-disc set called Poetry on Record, 98 Poets Read Their Work. And coming up next, you're going to hear a poem by Joy Harjo. Let me find her introduction or her bio here first. Joy Harjo was born on May 9th, actually, 1951, is an American poet, musician, playwright, and author. She is the incumbent United States Poet Laureate. I think maybe when this was written, that's true. So anyway, she was the United States Poet Laureate, the first Native American to hold that honor. She's also only the second Poet Laureate consultant in poetry to serve three terms. Harjo is a member of the Muscogee Nation. She is an important figure in the second wave of the literary Native American Renaissance of the late 20th century. She studied at the Institute of American Indian Arts, completed her undergraduate degree at the University of New Mexico in 1976, and earned an MFA at the University of Iowa in its creative writing program. In addition to writing books and other publications, Harjo has taught in numerous United States universities and performed at poetry readings and music events. Harjo is the director of For Girls Becoming, an art mentorship program for young women. Harjo has also played alto saxophone with a band, Poetic Justice, edited literary journals and written screenplays. In 2019, she was named the United States Poet Laureate. She is the first Native American to be so appointed. She's also the second United States Poet Laureate consultant poetry, as mentioned, to serve three terms. Her works also include themes such as defining self, the arts, and social justice, and uses Native American oral history as a mechanism for portraying these issues. Her use of the oral tradition is prevalent through various literature readings and musical performances conducted by her. Her methods of continuing oral tradition include storytelling, singing, and voice inflection in order to captivate the attention of her audiences. She published her first volume in 1975 and uses symbolism throughout her poetry to express her beliefs and values. She draws from personal experience to shape her writing. In addition to creative writing, Harjo has written and spoken about U.S. political and Native American affairs. Her website contains several blogs expressing her views on current political issues and her strong support for women's rights and equality. She is also an active member of the Muscogee Nation and writes poetry as a voice, quote, of the indigenous people, end quote. Harjo's poetry Harjo's poetry explores imperialism and colonization and her effects on violence against women. She sometimes places her poem in a common setting. Also in her poems, Harjo explores her Muscogee Cree background and spirituality in opposition to popular mainstream culture, and she writes about individual struggle. Of contemporary American people, Harjo said, "I see and hear the presence of generations making poetry through the many cultures that express America. They range from the ceremonial orality, which might occur from spoken word, to European fixed forms, to the many classical traditions that occur in all cultures, including theoretical abstract forms that find resonance on the page or in an image. Poetry also directly or inadvertently mirrors the state of the state, either directly or sideways," and that ends her quote. Awards. She has received nearly 40 awards for storytelling, poetry, and other artistic endeavors that include a National Endowment for the Arts Creative Writing Fellowship, the William Carlos Williams Award from the Poetry Society of America, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Native Writers Circle of the Americas, the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation Fellowship, and the Wallace Stevens Award for Poetry by the Academy of American Poets Board of Chancellors. And again, as mentioned, she was appointed as the United States Poet Laureate three times. Her storytelling, poetry, and music has appeared on six discs, and she has published two children's books and two books of nonfiction and 16 collections of poetry. Tell you what, here is Joy Harjo with her poem, and let me find the title here. Her poem called Grace. Just heard Joy Harjo with her performance and reading off of the four-disc set called Poetry on Record. 98 poets read their work, 1888 to 2006. I think I'm going to have a little more time than I thought I would at the end of this hour. I'm going to go ahead and bring in another poet that wasn't mentioned at the start. The next one on the list is, I'll introduce him and then play his one, and his is sort of a performance piece as well. And I'll do that instead of playing another song. So Juan Felipe Herrera was born in 1948 as a poet, performer, writer, cartoonist, teacher, and activist. Herrera was the 21st United States Poet Laureate from 2015 to 2017. His experience as a child of migrant farmers strongly shaped his work. Community and art have always been part of what has driven him. He graduated from San Diego High School in 1967 and received the Educational Opportunity Program scholarship to attend the University of California, Los Angeles, where he received his BA in social anthropology. Later, he received his master's degree in social anthropology from Stanford University, his master's of fine arts and creative writing from the University of Iowa. In 1990, he was a distinguished teaching fellow at the University of Iowa's Writers Workshop, and after serving as chair of Chicano and Latin American Studies Department of California State University, Fresno. In 2005, joined the Creative Writing Department at the University of California in Riverside. His experience as a farm laborer has strongly influenced his work. Growing up in the 60s and attending college in the 70s during the Chicano movement and more experimental writings such as the Beat Poets, writers like Luis Valdez and Allen Ginsberg inspired him. The great era of artistic experimentation also inspired his writing style, in which he challenges the borders between styles, forms, schools, and genres. Herrera, a writer constantly crossing borders, often writes about social issues. New York Times critic Stephen Burt praised Herrera as one of the first poets to successfully, quote, create a new hybrid art, part oral, part written, part English, part something else, an art grounded in ethnic identity, fueled by collective pride, yet irreducibly individual too, end quote. Herrera's publications include 14 collections of poetry, prose, short stories, young adult novels, and picture books for children, with 21 books in total in the last decade. Herrera was awarded the 2008 National Book Critics Award in Poetry, in 2012 appointed California Poet Laureate by then Governor Jerry Brown, and at that appointment in 2012, Herrera created the I Promise Joanna, Yo Te Prometo Joanna project, an anti-bullying poetry project. Joanna was an elementary school girl who was bullied and killed in an after-school fight. The first half asked parents to send in poems about the effects of the bullying. The second half of the project is to take action in preventing it. He hopes to collect the poems and publish it in a book in the future. I mean, that may have happened. This may be a little bit older at this point. At least it's probably at least a year or so older. Juan Felipe Herrera founded a number of performance ensembles during the last three decades. Among other awards not already mentioned, he's received the 2008 National Book Critics Circle Award in Poetry, 2009 Penn Beyond Margins Award, the Guggenheim Fellowship, California Arts Council grants awarded four times, Latino Hall of Fame Poetry Awards, twice awarded, National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship Awards, also twice awarded, the New York Public Library Outstanding Book for High School Students Award, UC Berkeley's Regents Fellowship, the 2017 Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Award, and in 2011 he was elected a Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. In 2015, he was appointed the first Chicano as U.S. Poet Laureate. And in 2016, Herrera was awarded an honorary doctorate from the Oregon State University. He's written 26 books and chapbooks or other publications of poetry. Again, here is Philippe. I'm sorry. Here is Juan Philippe Herrera with his piece called Logan Heights and the World. Here you go.
See the bay from the kitchen. We kicked a highway patrol out from our barrio and put a Chicano park in its place. Right across the street from La Central, where I would buy tortillas and spy at the tripitas through the butcher's window, noting how they were braided. Imagine, braids on tripitas? I'd walk home, all the way on National Street, to a gray Victorian house next to a Spanish restaurant, the only Mexican joint calling itself Spanish in the whole area. How do you like that? El Porvenir, another tortilleria painted in turquoise, stood out on the corner. I played with my avocado green top. Anyway, I lived in apartment number 9. Every now and then I would go out with Jaime and Miguel Estrada, who knew how to part his hair. We would kick back at the Coronet Theater and look at the cool dude, Pedro Infante and Maria Antonieta Pons and her hot legs while we spilled the salt and popcorn, 5 cents, on the floor. One time, I darted out into the street, making a liquor truck break every bottle as it slammed on the brakes. I was chasing Sammy Vasquez, the guy who wanted to dance with my girl, Mercedes Gomez, because she chose me and not him as a square dance partner in 5th grade. Yeah. A couple of years later, the city administration cut a freeway right through our barrio. Everything fell apart, vanished. The little houses with a geranium singing soprano, and the elastic kids grew transparent overnight. Me and Arnold Leyva, Raymond Nieto, Johnny, and Eva Estrada would walk out after school across the torn structures and sniff glue in the condemned apartments. Everyone lived in a studio set for a B-movie about the coming of Godzilla, a kind of urban ghost town where Father Rasura arrived one day to serve his time at Guadalupe Church. He showed us films and gave us donuts with chocolate as we sneered and rattled our fancy code languages. So we went to high school, finally. The silent kids in Mr. Whiteman's class. A stern and lanky crowd at lunchtime talking about Eric Fromm, Nietzsche, Zen, and James Brown and his brand new bag. We got into choir, sang in Italian, took auto shop, and ran cross country. By 11th grade, we began to grin, scoping out the moaning, phosphorescent tidal wave coming up somewhere near Ocean Beach, all the way from Rosarito, Ensenada, Mexicali. So when the police dynasty, the president of the zoo, an ex-Navy general, and the mayor, not to mention the vampire architects, decided to build a station across from La Central, still standing, we were ready. Our little red plastic watch had been ticking since we were 7 years old, playing marbles and spinning tops in the sector of the dead. By 67, the sparkling emeralds of the sea were in our hands. And by 70, we laid some of them down, forming a circle in the heart of the wasteland, a simple park. Chicano Park, a reminder to the world that we were on the loose.
And you just heard Juan Felipe Herrera and his performance in the fourth disc of the four-disc set called Poetry on Record, 98 poets read their work, 1888 to 2006. It is 55 minutes after 5 o'clock, and you know what? I probably should do this, and then I'll come back and maybe start to sort of close the show. How's that? Let's do this first.
Un, dois, tres, y...
Every Friday at 11 p.m., you can tune into CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca to listen to Bone Shook, a program that's almost too groovy for its own right. I'm your host, Chance, and I'll take you through songs across the world that'll make you want to move, groove, and schmoo.
In the 1970s, four Kingston women got together to discuss the idea of creating a community house, a place where grassroots organizations, families, and groups could gather, a place where food could be prepared and shared, new skills could be learned, and lively discussion could be encouraged. For over 30 years, Kingston Community House has provided low-cost meeting space for hundreds of groups, allowing people to come together to learn from one another, share resources, and trade skills. As it becomes safe once again to gather in person, we look forward to providing the Kingston community with a comfortable and convenient place to reconnect with one another. Located in downtown Kingston, we operate 7 days a week. For more information on Kingston Community House and how to book, please visit kingstoncommunityhouse.org.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
And you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And again, I'd like to thank you for having tuned in to the show today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Again, you just heard the sixth of what turned out to be. I wasn't even sure how long this was going to stretch out with throwing a little bit of music in there. Stretched out to be a 7-week run of that four CD disc set. So just to let you know, in case you liked what you heard today and hadn't heard some of the others, I do save every week's show to my blog space for the show at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. It does remain there for 4 years, and things are usually pretty well marked, and you can identify past programs. So if you're interested in more of the earlier readings from in that four-disc set series, I encourage you to go there. I usually get it uploaded to my blog space by about 7 o'clock when I get home. I hope to catch you here next week. Take care of yourself. Do stay tuned more immediately now, though. At the top of the hour, you're going to hear 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music, hosted by Rob Carnell, and that again runs each week from 6 to 8 o'clock here on CFRC 101.9 FM.